Hello and welcome to another edition of Talking Strategy, Making History. I'm Daraka, and with me is Dick Flax.
Hi there.
I'm going to say hi, Dick.
Yes. Yeah? Hi, Dick.
And joining us for a conversation today is Murad Mosarama, who's a colleague and friend of mine as an activist in the Democratic Party here in California and is based in the Sacramento area. And, you know, I understand you just, we were the day after or 2 days after an election in which you were campaigning for a seat on the Board of Education, on the County Board of Education. And for folks who don't know, Sacramento has been a real ground zero in the battle around school privatization, targeted with gobs and gobs of charter school money. And so everything that's going on there to preserve democratic education is, you know, important for the country. And with that, though, why don't you give our listeners just a little bit of an introduction to your work, yourself, and things that we should know about you before we jump into all the easy questions about geopolitics and conflict.
Thank you, Daraka. Great to be with you today on this podcast. As you said, yeah, I've been an activist within the Sacramento area community and also within the state party, the California Democratic Party at large. And, you know, I'm a tree hugger, environmental scientist by education. I went to Sac State and I became an activist within the locally within the environmental community. And I actually sat on the Environmental Council of Sacramento. And as a Palestinian American activist, basically, I always got asked about the Palestinian-Israeli issues. And I became an activist by default for the Palestinian cause. And I joined that movement within the party as an activist. And I became actually, I ran for election for the chair of the Arab American Caucus. And I was a chair for one term, actually. I did not run for the second term. But right now, I actually sit on the board of the Arab American Caucus as a treasurer for the caucus, as we need to go and continue the movement, continue our activism and talking about the issues that pertaining to the Arab American community at large, and especially about the foreign policy that entail within the Democratic Party platform, and also on a national level. So I was proud to be a delegate for Senator Bernie Sanders for DNC, and we brought in the same thing. Again, we brought in our voice to the DNC, and we formed a ground, and also we elevated the conversation around foreign policy within our activism there. And also locally, we have a chartered club, part of the Sacramento Central Democratic Central Committee, that is Democrats for Justice in Palestine. And that's, you know, I humbly the chairman of that club. And we do a lot of activism, education around the issues that pertain to our cause, the Palestinian cause. And recently we passed a resolution on the Central Committee. Actually was voted on unanimously about ceasefire. And, you know, I'm not the guy who's not able to work with the other side. And, you know, especially when folks come in and try to go and actually argue certain points in our resolution, I'm willing to listen. So we sat down and talked it over with a group of folks in the resolution committee here in our central committee. And that's why BAST, you know, got 100% of votes of the central committee by just talking to each other. Once again, yes, emotions are high on our side, and definitely there's a genocide being committed, and nobody can deny that. Over 30,000 people got killed, over 100,000 affected, and you know, the toll is still going, and we have to recognize that. And folks, even though the folks that might be opposed to the things that we advocate for, but they actually do recognize that a ceasefire is needed, and a negotiated safe return of the hostages and the Palestinian prisoners should be negotiated as well. And I think that common ground that among activists, again, folks are sitting on the left side or the right side of myself, we're in agreement that a ceasefire is needed. Just a little bit of background and a recent background about what we do here in Sacramento.
Look, could I just interject that we have another guest, which is Ada Larimore, yes. Hall, who's become a regular here on the podcast. So
Larimore Blackerby.
For the record. I'm sorry.
We didn't pass on both of my last names.
Okay, that's good for
without that being,
I'm sure she'll be glad
a little bit
that.
Too regal.
So anyway, and I wanted to ask Mo whether you what happened in the race for the school board.
That's a great question. Well, I was talking to Dereka briefly, and I ran against a lot of money, meaning, you know, the Charter School Association advocates ran actually their employee. One of their employee was the candidate for that seat. I saw the money flowing in, and basically almost $300,000 would put it in into that seat to make sure, you know, basically nobody can compete. And I ran on a platform of, you know, basically I'm a father of, I have five kids, and I got kids enrolled in a school. I'm involved in a school district, and I was the only, you know, Democrat endorsed candidate. And I, you know, ran a campaign. Obviously, it was a big district. You could not canvass all of it, but we trying to get an actual knock on some doors. And we, but unfortunately, we, you know, we came in short, unfortunately. And I did have a right wing also opponent who did not prevail as well. I actually did better than the right winger, the Trump supporter. So I did better than him. So that's the good news.
So it was like a charter school employee, a MAGA, get rid of CRT, Republican crazy nutbag, right. And you. This is America in 2024 for the County Board of Education, which for people that don't know or aren't in California, like in most counties is like uncontested, the same people for years, like not, you know, because they don't directly run the school system sort of thing. And so it just shows you where the battle is happening in so many fronts. Like, so thank you. For running.
Thank you, Derek. And actually, you brought in a good point. You know, you said that usually seems not contested because just 4 years ago, there was actually somebody just get elected in a different area where the seat was open, and she didn't have any opponents, so she was just elected by default. Now, school county boards are becoming battleground, unfortunately, for a lot of the right wing supported by groups like Moms for Liberty, which is one of my opponents, was supported by them. And, you know, it draws a lot of right-wing folks to get on, you know, they want to, unquote, control the school board and against indoctrination of our kids. That's the main message they're saying, that liberals are basically mostly with the CTA. They're attacking the CTA and the teachers union, which I was proud to be supported by the CTA and endorsed by our classroom teachers.
So let me pick up something and ask you a question. Something you said that is really interesting is that your county Democratic Party committee, so the board of the committee, passed a resolution calling for a ceasefire. It was unanimous and it was negotiated and so forth. And my sense is that the base of the Democratic Party right now is not actually that divided about sort of practical questions. Like, we might be divided on, is this a settler colonist project or, you know, this and that. But when it comes to what should happen tomorrow, it is very much united around a ceasefire, around, you know, getting back to the table to talk about a long-term solution democratically. We're on similar pages, if not the same page, when we're able to sit down and talk about it in a kind of non-loaded way. And then we have our president and many of our leaders in Congress and so forth, who just seem like they're in a completely different conversation, a totally different place. What's your sense of that divide, and what do you think can be done about changing it? Or am I crazy? Am I right in that general sense?
No, I think you're spot on. I think we as Democrats, as our base of the Democratic Party, as the activists, as the folks that are actually doing the work on the ground, and many of actually the Democratic voter base, they agree. It must be ceasefire is something like, you know, there's no argument. You know, just go ahead and do a ceasefire, negotiate the return of the hostages, and also find a permanent solution for the Palestinian struggle. I'm not going to argue two-state solution, one-state solution, but something that needs to be talked on. And the people on the ground are the folks that be negotiating that,
exactly.
Not us here from SoCal. We just talked about the school board race that just ran. You know, I did a text banking. You know, the most asked question in that text bank was, do you support a ceasefire?
Oh, wow.
That was the most asked question in a school board election. And obviously, you know, our answer, or you know, volunteers that were helping me doing the text banking. They will, you know, elaborate about, like, you know, our resolution we just passed in the central committee, and I was the co-author of that. I was also helping one of my friends who ran for city of Sacramento.
And one was helping Ada wanted to give you some congratulations.
Thank you.
She's with you.
I also was surprised how many people actually asked, do you support our, you know, does Katie, that's it, the candidate name, support ceasefire in the city council? Mm-hmm. Then I asked some assembly candidates as well, because some of them actually came out, you know, and said, hey, I support ceasefire. And why? I know I'm running for assembly, I'm not running for a federal office, but stuff like that sometimes come in to us at the state capitol as resolutions, and I'll be supportive of something like that. And also in their text banking, the most asked question was, do you support a ceasefire? This is among Democrats. These are Democratic candidates, and these are Democratic voters. So, yes, that's something that the president should consider. And I really not only – I believe the folks that asked those, they were not Arab Americans, by the way. They were young voters, mostly. When I, you know, I literally took a survey because I want to know who those folks are asking, because I, you know, obviously, you know, PDI, which is the voter file, and I look up the data, and I want to, you know, get kind of survey about who's asking those questions. And these are the folks from 18 to 42 years old. So these folks are asking these questions. Do you support ceasefire? What do you think about, you know, do you think, like, one of the questions, other one was, do you think it's a genocide? Do you think it was happening right now? And a lot of people think it is a genocide, like killing 30,000 people, indiscriminate bombing, starvation for the entire population. If you don't call this other than a genocide, I don't know what is other thing you can call it. These are the questions that candidates, including myself, were asked during campaign trails. Again, for local offices, for state offices. So imagine on a federal level. So I think the president should take that into account going into the general. A lot of folks here in California, I know me and Director were talking about if that vote's going to be counted or not. You know, most likely it won't be counted, but folks for the primary voting for the president, a lot of folks wrote down ceasefire on the right end. And it's a significant amount of folks. There was multiple voter guys that actually went out. One of the voter guys that went out, it literally says ceasefire voter guide, and went to a wide variety of folks. It wasn't only for, again, Arab American or Muslim Americans, or it went to a lot of folks, and mostly young folks actually were, you know, were posting that on their social media. So definitely it was on the ballot on Tuesday, on Super Tuesday, not only in Michigan a couple of weeks ago, not only in Hawaii during the caucuses, but it was on Super Tuesday. In Minnesota, I believe it was 19% uncommitted. So that equals to about 11 delegates. That is very significant of folks going and voting uncommitted. In Michigan, I believe it was about 13%. That equals to about 2 delegates. That is also significant, sending a message to President Biden. Hey, it is time to go and change your strategies. It's time to change your the way you're handling the relationship right now you have with Israel or with Prime Minister Netanyahu. And understand, like, you know, the administration or chief of staff is saying, hey, it's their own country. But when we send in over 200 tons of weapons unconditionally, you know, we could go ahead and hold off on that.
Yeah, let me point out that we are talking right now about 2 hours before the State of the Union address. So some people expect that something significant is going to be said by President Biden in a couple of hours about this very question. But my feeling has been they've been saying and signaling, well, we really don't like a lot of what Israel's doing in the war. We want to draw some kind of, we want to dissuade Netanyahu from going too far. But the actual delivery of weapons, the delivery of support has been unwavering and frighteningly so. So they're going to pour in, he's going to announce, I'm sure, significant increase in aid to the people in Gaza, while at the same time we're delivering weapons that prevent that aid from happening. So that's, I'm just sharpening the contradiction here, but maybe we are coming to a turning point. Maybe tonight's going to be the night. I wanted him to comment about the uncommitted campaign led by Palestinian activists and Arab and Muslim people in Michigan, Minnesota, and so forth, which is very sophisticated from an electoral point of view. They're very sharply defined in the rhetoric. They're not saying they'll never vote for Biden. They're asking him, demanding that he do the right thing. So what's your own personal hope, or what do you think the hope is among people you're working with who are in that camp? What do you really hope will happen?
Once again, the folks, the organizers in Minnesota, the organizers in Michigan, they had one basically united voices like, hey, we're not going to be committed to vote for someone that's basically sending those weapons and not doing anything about ending the genocide that's happening in Gaza, not calling for a ceasefire, ultimately showing the utmost support for Israel and their war in Gaza against the Palestinian people. You cannot, as you just mentioned about the aid, you cannot just go ahead and send 200,000 tons of weapons and go ahead and drop 100 tons of humanitarian aids by airplanes. They're just hypocrisy. You just cannot do that. That's not something we as Arab Americans here see as helping the situation in Gaza. Helping the situation in Gaza is calling for a ceasefire, pressure the Israeli government, stopping the military aid until they do a ceasefire, and condition that aid to Israel in the future. Condition the aid for not, you know, basically committing any human rights abuses, any genocides against the Palestinian people in their retaliation war, a so-called war on Hamas. You know, they've been in the war for how long now? And, you know, did they release any of the hostages? The main goals were to release the hostages to, unquote, destroy Hamas and bring peace to outside of Gaza. None of that happened, you know, in the war. And they've been dropping bombs daily on Gaza, and looks like they're still getting resistant from those forces on the ground in Gaza. And they did not find the hostages. On the opposite, actually, they killed many of the hostages during the bombing. Like recently, like, you know, the Hamas released a video showing three of the hostages were killed by the Israelis, allegedly. I'm not sure they were trying to even to save him. They were just killed during the bombing. So they're killing more of the hostages. And I think Netanyahu is not committed to return the hostages. And I think in his interest to get on to commit the hostages. I think that most of the Palestinian people and a lot of folks in the Israeli society also agree that Netanyahu is not interested in returning the hostages. He's only interested in his what's going to happen if he stops the war. His government might collapse. His unity government might collapse, and he might be going again to court for the corruption charges that he has, and that's going to end his political career. So he's more interested in his political career versus freeing the hostages and reaching an agreement with Hamas to negotiate safe return of the hostages and exchange for the Palestinian prisoner.
You know, and I would go much further, speaking as a Jewish person that cares about only himself and not the fate of the Jewish people in the world, or even necessarily what's good for the Israeli people in the long run. And right now, I mean, sadly and frighteningly, most people in Israeli Jews are supporting this war effort. I'm under the impression, by the way, that very poor reporting in Israel of what is being done in Gaza. It isn't simply, you know, this fever of war. It's fever of war that is enabled by the fact that people are not being confronted with what is happening. And I saw a report just the other day that when that shooting of people who were surrounding the aid coming in that marketplace, that really did hit home, in according to some reports in Israel. It actually had an effect. We don't know what the impact will be, but it's scary that they can be, ordinary people can in Israel can feel that this, they're on the right side, and they feel very aggrieved that the rest of the world is angry at them, but they don't even fully aware or even partially aware maybe of the full extent of what Israel is actually doing to the people and to the future. I would say. Anyway, that's my little speech on that. So I'm wondering, in terms of activism in the, on the part of people that you're working with, the Palestinian community and so forth, what's your domestic experience here in terms of Islamophobia and attacks on people, but also receptivity? You've given some indication. You say that these questions coming from citizens at meetings even of city council candidates suggest that there's a lot of, this is really important in, thing you're reporting on, which is there's this groundswell of feeling that something's got to really be done about this to stop this war. Is that your general experience, or what is it? What's your feeling about that?
Yeah, 100%. Like, you know, on we're talking about the Democratic Party activism, but we held a rally during the last convention in Sacramento, and it's an endorsing convention. We held the rally outside the convention, then we march after that to the convention, and a lot of the protesters actually were able to get in inside and did a sit-in, and end up shutting the operations of the convention. You know, usually caucus meetings and so forth were canceled by the chairman of the party as a result. And a lot of these folks were very unhappy with the Democratic Party, unhappy, obviously, with the president, and unhappy with the positions of a lot of politicians that, not talking about a ceasefire, not supporting a ceasefire, not strongly calling on the administration to go and stop what's happening right now on the ground in Gaza and the genocide. So a lot of folks actually, I was looking at the turnout of the election. A lot of folks were unhappy with Democrats. Like, I mentioned my school board run, and then, when it's like, hey, I'm the only Democrat endorsed candidate, believe it or not, from Democrats, like, hey, the Democratic Party right now turned us down as Democrat. And this is, again, it's not coming in from Arab American community. It's coming in from folks who are registered voters who vote always as a Democrat, but they're very disappointed with the Democratic Party, and especially with the president and many of our representation in Congress. Our local Congress folks that did not call out for a ceasefire right away, or they actually run around the war ceasefire with like conditional ceasefire or this and that, just to go and appeal to the two-sidism of the issue. And that's, there's no two side of how far can Israel go before somebody going to call out for a ceasefire, right? Yeah, 30,000, 35,000, how many homes? I don't think there's any functional homes right now in Gaza. You see, like, the folks, the refugees, like, 2.some million folks are in tents near Rafah, and also Netanyahu and the IDF are wanting to go and invade, or they want to go and actually conduct an operation in Rafah. How bad that could be. That will be a major massacre. You just mentioned the massacre just happened when folks were trying to get some aid from the truck. What threat did they bring to the IDF soldiers that were in tanks and Humvees on the ground? What threat? They're unarmed. They're trying to get flour so they can cook. That's what they were doing. And they start firing on them, and they said, they felt threatened. But their news reports from multiple independent news agencies showed the IDF firing on unarmed civilians. They're near starvation. They're trying to get some flour for their family. Over 100 were killed, plus hundreds of injured. Literally firing on them from their Humvees or from the Merkava, which is the Israeli armor. So I don't know what to tell you. If the administration of President Biden is not going to go talk about ceasefire tonight during his State of the Union address, and they're going to talk about a pathway to peace, hopefully very soon, and a negotiated peace with the folks on the ground, not something we're going to go ahead and bring in, or not something we're going to go to negotiate with the PA, the folks are actually in Gaza. And right now, the PA is not very popular in the Palestinian area because of their stand. And I'm pretty sure you heard about the recent resignation of the Palestinian cabinet that was put forward. But regardless, the president is actually, do I want to go and vote for president for another term for President Trump? No. Does any of the Arab American community want President Trump? No. But definitely they don't want a president who's not going to be siding with is not going to be calling out for a genocide when we know it is a genocide. Somebody who's not going to go ahead and stop the massacres that's happening right now in Gaza, and a president that's just going to be giving the utmost support for the Netanyahu government, the most extreme right-wing government in the history of the establishment of Israel. Like,
yeah, it's a dilemma. I mean, it's why I think Dick and I are both very encouraged by and supportive of this campaign around Uncommitted and finding ways to put pressure on the administration and democratic leadership and so forth, but also knowing that, you know, beginning with the Palestinians themselves onto everybody else, a Trump presidency would be just a complete fucking catastrophe. I mean, like, if you think things can't be worse than now, like, think again, like, they will be worse. And so, yeah, that's always a tough thing. And it's a very tough thing to, like, talk to voters about and, like, knock on doors and be like, hey, it'll be only half a genocide if you vote for us, you know. But half a genocide means there's a bunch of other people who are alive. It's awful.
So both of you are leaders in the Democratic Party in California. And I'm wondering, what I'm leading to is there within the framework of party activists and electeds and so forth, a peace faction that can come to the fore and really add to the pressure on the White House and so forth on this, or move things in different direction? And let me give you one example that's popped into my head as we were talking. So here's Kamala Harris. She's from California. She met with the centrist opposition figure in the Israeli government the other day. That was against Netanyahu's expressed statements. People are saying, some reports are, that she in the White House represents the voices calling for what you were advocating, Mo, just before, you know, a path to peace, moving toward the ceasefire, that kind of thing. I don't know whether you have any sense of her, and you don't have to. I wouldn't expect you to, but I guess that would be helpful. I'm thinking about my recollections during the Vietnam War, when it was really important in changing the war policy that finally some high, you know, people in the Senate, Democrats, came out in criticism and finally against the war policy. That was took years at that time. We need this to take weeks. So I'm wondering what you guys, both of you, think about the prospects of that kind of taking the grassroots movement now and having it actually voiced by, well, Bernie Sanders has. For example, is there anyone running for Congress in California who might be characterized as more of a peace-oriented candidate?
That's a great question. Yeah, as far as the Arab American community organizing, you know, as you said, like, you know, the Uncommitted vote was the biggest thing that got organized. And I think it did send a message to the administration, also the Biden campaign. The Biden campaign right now, as you know, for example, Michigan, he won Michigan by 150,000 votes last time. And right now, the Uncommitted was 101 in a primary election. So, you know, in general election, more people vote. So definitely, if he's not going to do something right now in the general, very likely to get on. Lose Michigan. Losing Michigan could cost the presidency. We could go ahead and go back to Trump. So among the Palestinian American, Arab American, Muslim Americans, like, hey, do you want to vote for somebody that want to deport us, or want to vote for somebody that want to kill us? That's literally what is the thinking, or what is that the slogan? Like, you know, you want to vote for somebody that want to deport you versus somebody want to kill you. So, and the genocide Joe becoming a slogan among every chant, every time there's a protest. In Sacramento or in San Francisco or in cities in Michigan, always the chant, other than other chants, but mostly genocide Joe. So if that's what you want to go down in history as a president and being a genocide Joe, that's up to him. So it's going to be a one-term president with a genocide next to him. That will be up to him coming up in November. If it's not, again, we have only an hour probably right now, or less than 2 hours, to get and see what he's going to say during the State of the Union. But if there's no policy changes, these uncommitted will be committed not to vote. So I'm not going to say these uncommitted voters are going to go vote for a Trump, but I can tell you they're going to sit home and not going to vote. And that's going to cost the president another term. and that's going to cost us to suffer under Trump administration. And again, I don't want to do that. Most of the Arab American community, most of the Muslim community, they don't want to do that. But again, do you want to support somebody who want to kill us, or you want to support somebody that want to deport us? That's what's on the ballot. And they use that, as you know, in a democracy, you use the ballot box to send a message. That was the biggest message to do that is through the uncommitted. That was the best message that we could send to the president and also to the Biden campaign, to the president's campaign folks. And from what I heard from multiple, you know, news that reported, a lot of his advisors are advising him to go ahead and do something, or definitely that will cost him the election. And also within the Democratic Party, folks are advising him to go ahead and do something, or that will cost him the election. I think it was a strong message. I think, as an Arab American, we're very proud of the organizing that took place, and also our allies organized with us as well. And again, it wasn't just a movement from the Arab American community, but also from allies around us. For example, Jewish Voice for Peace been with us from the start. Young folks, if not now, Sunrise Movement and others that organized those weekly protesting at the state capitol just a couple months ago, where the entire session of the legislature was shut down from a protest that young folks did at the state capitol in California, in Sacramento. So I just want to say, if President Biden does not act immediately and does not address it in the State of the Union, I can guarantee you that a lot of these folks uncommitted and more. Probably that number will be doubled because, again, a lot of folks do not vote in the primaries. And these numbers are significant in a primary election. The President Biden and the Democratic Party will lose the election coming up in November.
And I mean, you're saying that, but I know I even have, you know, lots of people that I know in town here, not necessarily pro-Palestinian, agree that that's the sense that they have, that Biden has to change the policy as part of necessary to having a chance in this upcoming election, and not only Biden, but the whole fate of the democracy is at stake, really, in this contest. I wonder whether you have much contact with Palestinian student supporters on campuses, and whether you have anything to say about the campus situation, because that's where a lot of direct conflict is happening in America right now, is on university campuses.
Yeah, as I said, most of these protests, most of these actions are led by young people. I was very inspired by a lot of them. You know, Students for Justice in Palestine and other movements on the school campuses are, you know, basically organizing around ceasefire, organizing around putting pressures to elected officials, to city councils, for example, going into city council meetings and speaking in public comments and pressuring, you know, local elected officials to issue resolutions calling for a ceasefire. And the movement across the state has been very successful. Many city council actually issued resolutions calling for a ceasefire and calling on President Biden to support a ceasefire. And that could not have happened without these young folks going into these meetings, speaking in public comments, providing personal stories. Here in, you know, our town, Elk Grove, many families lost not only one family members, like, you know, some lost 10 family members, some lost 70 family members. Like one of Arab American elected actually members to the school board, Bassem Okara, lost over 70 family members in Gaza and here in Sacramento. So it is something that we go and we talk to our elected officials and we let them know our personal stories, especially those folks that lost directly. I lost a friend of mine that was a professor in Gaza that came in here to Sacramento, actually, and, you know, gave a speech, a very educated young man, and he blessed his soul. So everyone, a Palestinian activist, knew someone that actually recently got killed during the bombardment of folks, indiscriminate bombing in Gaza. And some of it, I won't say it's indiscriminate. Sometimes we target in hospitals, and they say, well, Hamas using a hospital as a operation base, or there is a tunnel underneath the hospital. They did not find any evidence of that, and they're still targeting hospitals, like, you know, babies in incubators. Who does that? That when people see these images, and not only our community, anyone, these are terrible images of not war, of organized genocide against an entire people, an entire population. And we heard that from the right-wing folks in the government, from Itamar Gavir and his supporters. And they were reciting some verses from the Old Testament, calling the people of Gaza the Amaleks, and, unquote, don't show mercy. You know, basically kill all of them, the young, the old, the women. And this is the kind of government that's right now running the state of Israel and calling on the war. Is the folks that are very right, the folks are, again, reciting verses from the Old Testament, calling for genocidal war against an entire population. And that's something that President Biden needs to listen to the base of the Democratic Party, listen to the folks that are activists within the Democratic Party, listen to the Arab American community who sent him a message through the uncommitted votes recently on Super Tuesday. So,
yeah, I would just let me jump in there and say that in terms of the opposition to Biden's approach, or like, you know, a movement within the amongst elected officials, elected Democrats, or, you know, parts of the policymaking apparatus, I think there are people who have realized that things have shifted in the base, that things have shifted on the ground in Palestine and Israel, that, and, you know, I think Biden came in wanting to ignore the Middle East. He doesn't like it. He's not interested in it. And then these things keep happening that, you know, are like, hey, it's still here and it's still a conflict zone and it's still important and there's still human beings, you know, involved. And there are, I think people, I wouldn't say it's a majority, but I think there's a big significant plurality even amongst leadership or elected officials, at least, that are like, bro, this is not 1997. And so, and I think you see that if you want to see a map of that congressionally, like look at where AIPAC and Democratic Majority for Israel are spending hundreds of millions of dollars to influence the outcomes of Democratic primaries, to influence local elections, to influence internal Democratic Party discussion, like all of that, and have been for years, and they're ratcheting it up, I think, in large part because they know that, I think, starting with the last Gaza war, public opinion and just the sort of perspective of the world, the perspective of the average citizen has shifted. It's very different. And just the long overdue promise of a Palestinian state that is just the clock has been ticking on for so long. All of those things, I think, have led to the fact that there are voices in Congress, voices in the Senate with both, you know, Sanders and Elizabeth Warren and others who are saying things about Israel, about our relationship with Israel, about Palestine, about the war in Gaza that, would not have been said 30 years ago because they've recognized this shift. Sorry, Ada's very upset about the horrible discourse amongst elites in the United States in general. But it's like, I think it's taking like a bunch of cold showers for Biden to even see it. And lastly, I'd say, like, I don't make too much of the meeting between the vice president and Benny Gantz, because I think what we definitely know is that Barack Obama and Biden, they hate Netanyahu. I mean, there's no love there. And ever since the Republicans had Netanyahu come and speak to Congress and like made this very partisan, they don't like him. It's like obvious. They don't trust him, et cetera. And that they want him replaced. It's like they want the administration would like to see regime change in both the Palestinian Authority and Israel in that sense. Right. You know, whether or not Gantz is the real change is a different question, but anyway, I think that was all very choreographed and so forth. All of that said, like, it may well be that Kamala, as someone who's like not an octogenarian who doesn't care about the Middle East and is sort of on his way out of everything, like that she's more forward looking about it than the president is. Yeah, that's totally possible. But I don't think she's like a a champion for peace or Palestinian rights or anything like that. I just think it's gotten so bad that there's some parts of it. But again, go and look at that AIPAC map. Look at what they're spending against like the entire squad. Look at what they just spent in this race in California down in Orange County to go after Dave Min for Katie Porter's seat. You know, they spent $4 million plus attacking Dave Min. He's not even, and they lost, which is a great sign. Absolutely. But they didn't even, like, he's not even like super much a champion, but they have the money to burn to try to micromanage who the Democratic caucus is on their one issue, which is the interests of a different country. I mean, it's very weird. It's all very, very strange when you sit back and think about it. Anyway, that's my two cents about that. What I'd like to hear a little bit, Mo, before we wrap up from you is, you know, can you tell people a little bit about that fight within the Democratic Party, like in primaries, in our conventions, in our meetings, and so forth, and the sort of, yeah, the, like, what are good examples of where that fight has been maybe constructive or something? What kind of role do you think these very well-financed, you know, pro-Israel sort of organizations and networks, what role do they play? And then what kind of role does your things like your club that you're part of, or the Palestinian Democratic Club, what kinds of things you need, does a club like that need to try to turn the tide or turn the discussion?
That's a good question. Yes, definitely. You know, our main goal is to go and actually engage in conversation and not to have a one-sided conversation on the issues that pertain to our people and our cause. And we've been very successful in doing such. And as you mentioned, there's a lot of well-funded organizations. We're not a well-funded organization. We're grassroots-based. And right now, hopefully, we can make that organization a statewide that's chartered by the Democratic Party of California. So we're working on the ground to set that. As I mentioned, during the convention, we organized that rally outside the convention, and it was very well attended with over 3,000 delegates and non-delegates that came into that rally, including elected officials from the Sacramento County community that attended the rally. And the message was clear. We send the message, and most of the delegates, and I can tell you right now that the majority of the delegation, the majority of the delegates, elected delegates through ADEM or Central Committee, they are in support of not only a ceasefire and a solution, they're supportive of our cause of a just solution for the Palestinian people. The delegates are appointed by elected officials. That's a different story, as we know how they usually vote, and, you know, basically they're boss. But we, the elected folks, we're not boss. We're unbossed, and we follow what is right. And I think the majority of the Democratic Party delegations are such. The thing is, the leadership and certain leadership do not have that ear to listen, unfortunately. And we're working on that. We're, you know, once again, one of the things that we've been building is, you know, our relationship with great people like Daraka, for example, a great leader that we miss dearly on the Democratic Party leadership. And he was part of a committee, the Resolutions Committee, where he championed elevated our voices, and it was very well appreciated. So that's the battle that we actually took. Like, for example, a resolution committee were setting up rules on the fly to try and block resolutions to avoid us talking about the issues pertaining to the human rights of the Palestinians and anything that comes in. They're trying to go and bury it in a consent calendar or set up some rules or dig up any rules that to prevent us from actually talking about it, not just to pass a resolution, even to talk about it. So that's an unfortunate reality that we were dealing with, but we overcome that. We organized, we gathered more support, and we still engaged. If you're trying to get and disengage us, they actually gave us motivation to be more engaged and more involved in our activism and to talk about the issues that are actually important to us. And people like Daraka, that we call an ally, and Daraka is somebody that actually can work with everyone. And he even tried to go and mediate one time in a resolution where we actually agreed on some language and we adjusted some language just to go ahead and, you know, show that we came in good faith to go and be able to talk about the issues that pertaining to our cause and actually bring some awareness. That's usually okay. I'm okay. Like, for example, I just mentioned the ceasefire resolution on the Central Committee here in Sacramento. I was willing to go and negotiate it, but hey, we have three major things. One, a ceasefire to the war that's happening. Next, we're going to go to negotiate an exchange of the hostages for the Palestinian prisoners. And again, that's up to the folks on the ground to going to be able to do that. And also a bath to humanitarian aid. And these are three nobody disagreed on. And it passed again unanimously on the Central Committee. So yes, when we usually trying to organize, we go against big funded organization, very well organized. But I'm not going to say our activism 10 years ago is the same as today. It got elevated. We got more ground support. We got more folks engaged, and we got more young people are in the forefront on carrying the torch for our activism that when we started. And that's something we will continue to do as long as there's an occupation, as long as there's an apartheid-like system on the ground in the Holy Land.
Dick, do you have anything you want to
wrap up with? Maybe our vibrations are going to reach the president as he gets ready to speak on the State of the Union. We'll see. I really appreciate the chance to get to know you, Mo, and really appreciate the work that you do and what you had to say with us here. Is a very clear message, and it's inspiring in a way, given the grimness of everything, to think that maybe what you're articulating is actually the basis of a lot of coming together of people at the grassroots that will help bring about something, a semblance of a humane outcome, a democratic, small d, democratic outcome of this horrible moment that we are in. But thanks for being willing to come with us tonight here.
Yeah, thanks so much.
If a song could bring us together across the planet that gave us birth, to act as one, bring peace and justice all around this shattered earth. If a song could take down borders, take down fences, make them fall, liberate all those imprisoned, kept behind the ghetto walls. If a song could stop the bombs, so the next might be the last. If a song could change the future, so it won't be like the past. If a song could be a missile fired from the Iron Dome, if it could protect the children, keep them safe within their homes. If a song could raise an army and transport it on command, take us all to Palestine to defend the Holy Land. If a song could be concrete and put to use to rebuild, if it might turn back the clock.